the UFO silences. Introduction, Watch Out Behind You. By John A. Keel, author, Disneyland of the Gods. And Strange Mutants. Close the doors. They're coming in the windows. That was a popular expression about 30 years ago, taken from the lyrics of a hit song now long forgotten. Close the windows. They're coming in the doors. The songwriter had probably never heard of the mysterious men in black, MIBs, but he might have been writing about them. They have been sneaking up on unwary UFO witnesses and ufologists for generations, often causing great confusion and sometimes outright terror. In more recent years, they have been the subject of a number of commercial motion pictures and, back in the 1960s, an actor named Roy Thinnett chased them week after week in a highly rated TV series. In England, a rock group named The Men in Black has achieved great notoriety. The MIBs have become a part of the underground culture everywhere. Most UFO fans credit the late Gray Barker with having invented the MIBs for his classic book They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. Actually, Gray simply rediscovered an ancient phenomenon. Their presence has been observed throughout history, in many different contexts. In the Middle Ages, there were constant reports of sinister gentlemen in black garments who appeared in remote areas of Greece, Hungary, Poland, etc., where they were credited with acts of vampirism. Dead animals and humans were often found in their wake, sucked dry of blood. Like our modern MIBs, they were often described as having an oriental cast to their features and they spoke with strange accents. In the ancient religion of Wicca or witchcraft, a man in black holds a prominent symbolic meaning. In many rites of witchcraft, a member of the coven dresses in black to represent the MIB. The fairy lore of the Celtic countries is also filled with tales of men in black. In fact, part of the fairy belief includes fairies who are the size of normal men and who walk almost unnoticed among humans except for their black clothing. Like their smaller counterparts, they were said to be great mischief makers. When the MIBs began appearing in areas where UFO sightings were numerous, the early UFO investigators tried to connect them exclusively to UFOs, and their usual reasoning was that the mystery men were somehow related to the government or the Air Force. It was true that some government agents were and are fond of black suits and wraparound sunglasses. For example, after Lee Harvey Oswald was linked with the assassination of President Kennedy, it was reported that a group of men in black suits descended on his old military unit and rifled the files. Obviously, they must have belonged to some intelligence group like the CIA. Their black suits were almost a uniform, like the dark clothes worn by the Secret Service men who attempt to protect the president. When, in August 1967, an enraged grizzly bear killed two campers deep in the woods in the Glacier National Park in Montana, a mystery man in a black suit, tie and black oxfords appeared briefly. What he was doing in the middle of the forest in such impractical clothing, and how he managed to hike there, was never explained. He briefly joined the horrified group of campers clustered around the mutilated victims and then faded back into the night. Was he a true MIB or just an out-of-place tourist? Men in black are also an integral part of the Oriental belief in the King of the World. Ancient tradition in parts of China, Tibet and India claims that there is an underground city where the King of the World runs everything by sending spies and minions to the surface. They dress in black robes and suits and, of course, their countenances are very oriental. In the Middle East, they move around the deserts in black robes and headdresses. All of these characters are known liars and hoaxers, and kidnappers. They might claim to be from Agartha, the underground city, or from a far-off kingdom or even a distant star system like the Pleiades. This is why the Christian Bible pointedly warns us to beware of those who profess to represent powers and principalities and tells us not to go out into the desert to meet with them. No Oriental would be surprised to hear that an MIB had turned up deep in the Glacier National Park on the night of two terrible deaths. As you can see, men in black is really a generic term. Many types of mystery men can, and do, fall into this ominous category. There are literally thousands of detailed reports scattered throughout the UFO literature describing very peculiar strangers who appeared during UFO flaps. Sometimes their clothes are ill-fitting and their demeanor is very weird. Sometimes they themselves are hunchbacked, crippled or grotesquely malformed. They can speak in a mechanical-like voice or appear to have trouble breathing. They behave irrationally, too. They might try to drink a bowl or jello, or they might eat a cigarette. In many cases, they appear to be wearing ill-fitting wigs. Witnesses have often commented on their bad toupees. If they represent some superior technology from some other star system, as many UFO fans like to believe, why can't they cover their bald pates with a decent wig? Very often the witness doesn't even realize he or she has encountered an MIB type. They can pose as salesmen, Seventh-day Adventists or just lost tourists. If they arrive in an automobile, it is likely to be an expensive model with mud-stained license plates. In many cases, they have visited isolated farms in hard-to-reach places without any car in sight and walking through mud and goo without dirtying their pristine shoes. How can you tell if they aren't who they claim to be? Simple, they don't really try to sell you anything if they say they are a salesman. Instead, they try to pump you for information or they make disquieting remarks about your past or your future. They also have a startling way of simply disappearing after they speak with you. That is, instead of walking back down the muddy road, they just seem to vanish when you look away and then look back again. Some of our MIBs could be apparitions or hallucinations. They need not be a part of our reality, although they may seem very real while you are confronting them. Some witnesses have, in fact, reported spells of dizziness, lapses of memory and other symptoms that clearly indicate their MIB encounter was not real. Many of the same symptoms occur in close UFO sightings, so there is a positive relationship between some MIB experiences and some UFO manipulations. The human mind is being assaulted and the powers of perception are being deceived. This could be a form of hypnosis or something more subtle. In the fairy lore, victims of this process were said to be enchanted. There doesn't seem to be one simple answer to the MIB mystery. As you read the many varying accounts in this book, you will realize the frightening complexity of it all. Some reports seem to be pointless practical jokes. Others contain elements that suggest these beings are desperately trying to convey something to us, that they are trying to communicate with us on our own level and usually botching it. One thing is certain, though. The reports in this book will keep you awake at night and make you nervous whenever you see a black Cadillac parked near your home. There is someone or something out there, and they are watching you. _ John A. Keel, New York, NY. The Men in Black, Agents of Terror. Visits by unknown agents are seeded throughout UFO literature and newspaper accounts of flying saucer sightings. For many years they were overlooked or not recognized for what they were. Today just about every UFO investigator has encountered these men in black during their research. The history of demonology, witchcraft and the occult are filled with similar incidents, leading one to speculate that the UFO phenomenon is at least partly psychic in nature. For example, researcher Alan Greenfield has pointed out that there is usually a consistent reference associating the term black men with the devil, along with a mention of an Indian-like appearance supposedly attributed to the devil by witches. There appears to have been a wave, Greenfield notes, of these cases starting at about the time of the Elizabethan post-Reformation era in the 1600s. Several occult volumes classify these beings into a group of their own and refer to them as men in black, demons, devil, apparition, or black mana, the latter being the most commonly used. One such instance, taken from Montague Summers' book The Werewolf, involves the case of a werewolf and a lord of the forest, described as being tall and dark, dressed in black. And in Witchcraft by Penny Thor Hughes, there is an allusion to the devil's form of dress as being black. But such tales from the 1600s were not uncommon to the North American colonies at that time. There is a brief mention by Cotton Mather, the famed witch hunter of colonial New England, of the black man mentioned by the Indians. Most interesting is the instance of a man dressed in black alluded to at the witch trials in Salem, supposedly being the devil who had been the cause of all the disturbance. American folklore holds many frightening tales of the devil, or demons, who roams the countryside on a dark horsey as opposed to today's TMS mib who arrive in dark autos. There are other tales of encounters with the devil in the woods and of apparitions which seem to fit within the context of this enigma. In the book Flying Saucers in the Bible by Virginia Brasington, Sorcerian, 1966, there is a fantastic story of the Great Seal of the United States and its mysterious origin which seems to hint of a mib. Supposedly the design was given to Thomas Jefferson while walking in his garden one night by a man in a flowing black cape. The seal is actually a reproduction of the lost city of Petra in northern Arabia, once controlled by a mysterious Arabian race known as Nabateans. Many persons have described the ancient city as half as old as time and is obviously the work of a very advanced technology for its time. The above material is taken from an article by Dennis Stamey which appeared in The Truth About the Men in Black published by Kurt Glumzer, which is one of the increasing number of sources for material on this subject. The Men in Black also appeared during several UFO flaps in the last century. In 1864, a UFO dropped several artifacts over a small community in Texas. They were placed by the citizens of the town in the front window of a store on the main street of town. The next day a traveling dealer stopped by and offered the shopkeeper a good price for the objects and carted them away with him. Several similar incidents happened in 1897 and 98. Many of the occupants observed during this period were said to have oriental features, dark complexions, slight stature and a heavy, undefinable accent too identical to the features described by observers of the MIB, who continue to harass and frighten witnesses to this very day. The current era, off the coast of Tacoma, Washington, on Maury Island, three lumberjacks watched as a giant donut-shaped craft blew up, spewing a heavy stream of white-colored metal over the ground. The stunned men collected samples, which in falling had killed their pet dog and damaged their boat. They then proceeded home without telling anyone what they had seen. The next morning, June 22, 1947, at 7 o'clock, there was a loud knock on the door of one of the witnesses, Harold Dahl. A man dressed in a black overcoat and a black suit said that he wanted to talk about something that concerned them both. Despite the fact that none of them had breathed a word to anyone, this man described to Dahl in vivid details exactly what had happened on Maury Island, and warned him not to talk with anyone about what he had accidentally stumbled upon, that is, if he valued his welfare and that of his family. Certainly, Dahl and the others would have consented to this request. They felt it was a matter of national security and feeling the object was a secret weapon of the US government, they wouldn't want a foreign power to get hold of any classified information. 3 days later, Kenneth Arnold was flying his single-engine plane over the thin cloud-covered peaks of Mount Rainier when he saw something flitter in the sunlight. Looking out over the mountaintops, he watched as 9 gleaming objects, in perfect formation, flew just below the cloud layer. They were traveling at tremendous speed and their maneuverability indicated that they were manufactured by a superior intelligence. After Arnold landed, newsmen clustered around asking for a description of what he had observed. The pilot told them that the objects closely resembled the motion of saucers skipping over water. The term flying saucer was born, though it has stuck to this day. Harold Dahl, having read of Arnold's sighting, felt there was no reason for him to remain silent about what he had seen only days before. Above all, he was one up on Arnold. He had actual fragments from one of these ships. When news of the exploding object over Maury Island reached Kenneth Arnold, he decided to make a special trip to Tacoma to talk with Dahl and the other witnesses. He felt that together they might be able to come up with some joint conclusion as to what they had seen. Upon arriving in Tacoma, the man who gave flying saucers their name, met a battered Harold Dahl. Arnold describes this first meeting in his book The Coming of the Saucers, Amherst Press. For nearly 2 hours Harold Dahl told me of all the sad experiences he had had since the 21st of June. He said you couldn't blame any of the experiences he had to anyone, that just by coincidence he nearly lost his job, just by coincidence he nearly lost his son, his wife had become ill, and he had lost a tremendously good boom of logs that he had salvaged from the bay when an unusual tide had somehow broken the moorings one night. This was a major loss to his finances, as the boom was worth over $3,500. The engines on their boat wouldn't start in the mornings, the boat sprang leaks. All in all, he had had a horrible time in keeping from going completely broke and from losing his family and home through sickness or accident. It almost seemed as if someone, or something had placed a curse on him. Determined not to give up his investigation of this affair, Arnold interviewed all of the witnesses in his hotel room. During the course of the grueling cross-examination, they were disturbed several times by phone calls from a reporter for the local Tacoma paper who insisted that he was receiving tips from an anonymous caller who knew exactly what was going on inside Arnold's suite. The voice on the other end of the phone had somehow managed to give the paper's feature writer a word-by-word description of their conversation. Arnold knew that it was impossible for any of those present to be leaking information to the press, since no one had left the room. A careful check for concealed microphones revealed nothing. Yet someone, somewhere, knew their every move. The saddest part of any saucer incident took place when two young Army investigators, Captain William Davidson and Lieutenant Frank Brown, were killed as they were returning to Hamilton Field in California with specimens of the material believed to have been part of the UFO which disintegrated over Maury Island. The plane they were piloting caught on fire and crashed. Although the other men aboard the military aircraft had parachuted out in time, Brown and Davidson were not so lucky. Tacoma Times reporter Paul Lance wrote a story the following day with screaming headliners as sabotage hinted in crash of Army bomber. Lance claimed that the mysterious telephone informer had once again called his office and indicated that the plane had been sabotaged or shot down to prevent shipment of their flying disc fragments to Hamilton Field. Lending substance to the caller's story, continued Lance's account, is the fact that 12 hours before the Army released official identification, he correctly identified the dead in the crash as Captain William Davidson, pilot, and First Lieutenant Frank M. Brown. At McCord Field, an intelligence officer confirmed the mystery caller's report that the ill-fated craft had been carrying classified material. Directly or indirectly, two young officers died because of a flying saucer. They were the first, but there have been others. The Bender episode, in 1952, a Bridgeport, Connecticut, man named Albert K. Bender, organized a UFO research group which he called the International Flying Saucer Bureau. The IFSB was well received and in no time at all became a thriving organization with members in most states, and in various foreign countries. Suddenly, one day, Bender announced that he was closing his group upon orders of a higher authority. Bender insisted that he had been visited by three men, who, although otherwise very normal in appearance, had worn black suits and hats. They revealed to the Connecticut group leader the secret of the saucers and then warned him not to discuss anything about their visit. "We shall probably never know the complete circumstances surrounding the visitation, but from the little Bender revealed at the time, we can state the following with a reasonable amount of certainty." Bender had been thinking of a UFO theory, which he eventually sent to a certain other person. Shortly thereafter the three men came, and one of them was carrying in hand the same sheet of paper that Bender had mailed. The visitors were very threatening in their manner, hinting at dire consequences if Bender printed his theory, as he had originally intended to do. For several hours two of the men drilled the researcher on the explanation for the UFO mystery, while the third merely sat and carefully observed Bender. "The story they gave was fantastic and extremely frightening," Bender later said, "and it portended great changes in all fields of human endeavor, particularly in science." Before leaving, one of the men turned toward Bender and said, "If I hear another word from your office, you're in trouble." Later Bender made a telephone call to a friend in which he casually mentioned his theory and subsequent visitation of the three men. Immediately after hanging up, the phone rang. A voice uttered that he knew of Bender's conversation and that he had made a bad slip and warned him to be more attentive in the future. From this moment on, Ben refused to discuss anything else concerning his visitation or theory. In 1953, several other researchers had similar visits from enigmatic entities who bestowed the discs upon them after they had been very close to printing the truth, unknowingly, in their publications. One of those visited was Edgar Jarrold, head of the Australian Flying Saucer Bureau, and a regular correspondent of Bender's. In fact, many researchers suspect that Jarrold is the one to whom Bender first imparted his secret. Jarrold seems to have undergone the eerie spectrum of visitations, weird phone calls and poltergeist activity. Jarrold was also puzzled by a mysterious black car which hung around his office at night. The auto contained two persons who evidently had him under surveillance. Although no one knows what became of the Australian investigator, apparently the ultimate climax came when he was in a large department store in Sydney. Jarrold was at the top of a flight of stairs leading from the ground floor when he received a violent push from the back, which sent him flying downstairs. This took place in broad daylight and from all accounts nobody was standing near him. Whatever pushed him was invisible, yet retained its physical bulk in order to carry out the attack. This ties in with poltergeist activity reported in connection with UFO sightings in many areas including Point Pleasant, West Virginia, home of the Mothman. In Canada, recently, an entire household was besieged by invisible entities soon after the occupants had close UFO sightings. At about the same time, in Toledo, Oregon, the residents of this small community were puzzled with the frequent visitations made by strange crawling lights which seemed to move up the very walls of their homes. A UFO flap was in the process during this period and sightings included reports of stump-like creatures and pulsating UFOs which brightened up the neighborhood at night. Kenneth Arnold himself seems to have been visited by these invisible entities. At my home I have been visited by unseen entities whom I believe to be pilots of these weird discs. They were invisible to me and made no attempt to communicate. I was aware of their presence because I could see my rugs and furniture sink down under their weight as they walked about the room or sat on various objects. In many cases, these poltergeists are the forerunners of the men in black who frequently turn up anywhere from 24 to 48 hours after these invisible pranksters first show themselves. In some cases, the silencers seem to bring about these occurrences which follow shortly after their visits. Since the beginning in 1967, the activities of these MIB have been on the rise. Important investigators across the country have reported a weird series of events which include strange phone calls, visits by invisible beings and harassment by various persons claiming to be from the government. They have continually photographed the homes of persons having close encounters with UFOs and have disguised themselves as government officials, salesmen, poll takers and termite exterminators, in order to gain access to saucer information. Because the Air Force has been accused of sending these individuals, on March 1, 1967, a memo entitled Impersonations of Air Force Officers signed Lieutenant General Hewittless, Air Force Assistant Vice Chief of Staff, was sent to all commands. It read, "Information, not verifiable, has reached HQ USAF that persons claiming to represent the Air Force or other defense establishments have contacted citizens who have sighted unidentified flying objects. In one reported case, an individual in civilian clothes, who represented himself as a member of NORAD, demanded and received photos belonging to a private citizen. In another, a person in an Air Force uniform approached local police and other citizens who had sighted a UFO, assembled them in a schoolroom and told them that they did not see what they thought they saw and that they should not talk to anyone about the sighting. All military and civilian personnel and particularly information officers and UFO investigating officers and UFO investigating officers who hear of such reports should immediately notify their local OSI officers. Some more men in black cases, according to Saucer News, Mr. Tad Jones, who witnessed a hovering sphere on a major highway in January, 1967, received two threatening notes warning him not to tell anyone what he had seen. The printing of these prank warnings was identical to the printing of the note placed under the door of Connie Carpenter in Middleport, Ohio. Respected researcher John Keel, author of numerous articles and books, has written extensively about would-be kidnappers who have come after UFO witnesses and UFO not sighters. On Long Island, two men in Air Force uniforms harassed UFO witnesses. One of these men identified himself as Lieutenant Frank Davis and threatened two different people with a revolver, warning them to watch out who you talk to. It almost seems as if this MIB had stolen his identity by combining the names of the two Army investigators who died in the airplane crash in the Maury Island case. If so, it was a sick disguise. A Colonel John Dalton interviewed at least three other Long Island residents and asked them to fill out complicated forms which contained involved questions about the witnesses' personal lives. Through officials on Long Island, John Keel had a check run on the men. The Air Force denied that it knew anything about either one or that men with those names were assigned anywhere on the island. Lieutenant Davis turned up again in a postman's uniform and later engaged in taking photographs of the homes of UFO sighters. In yet another MIB case, a black Cadillac made a deliberate attempt to run over a UFO witness on the main street of a Long Island town. During the same period, one of my close friends, investigator Robert Easley, of Defiance, Ohio, was reportedly followed by a man in a black sedan with no license plates. The man was dressed in black shoes, black pants, and a blue pullover shirt. In the wee hours of July 11, 1967, Mr. Easley was awakened by a phone call from a lady who told him that she and seven others were observing two bright fast-moving UFOs. After she hung up, he immediately got dressed and went to the scene. While checking on this report, he noticed that he was being followed by a man in a black sedan with no license plate. On July 15, he was again followed by the same man in the same car as he was driving home. When he pulled into his driveway, the unknown car sped off. Later that evening, as he sat talking with his girlfriend on the front porch, the car came down the road and stopped right in front of the house. As soon as the topic of UFOs entered their conversation, Easley could feel the man looking at them. When they got off the subject, the car left. But when they got back on it about an hour later, the same car came back again. It was as if the driver could hear what they were saying or read their minds. On July 17, as Easley was checking out another routine UFO report, the man appeared and followed him to and from the scene of the sighting, dressed in the same black shoes, black dress pants and dark pullover shirt. Between the 11th and 17th of July, Bob received a total of 12 strange phone calls. In each case, the only sound on the other end of the line was a strange beeping noise. Each call lasted for about 15 seconds, followed by complete silence. The beep sounded far away, as if coming from a machine. In Europe as well, witnesses are being threatened into silence. Mysterious voices and sounds are appearing on telephones and tapes, and imposters pretending to be either famed saucer investigators or government officials are visiting contactees and those claiming to have observed UFOs at close range. Even Dr. J. Allen Hynek ran into these accounts. In the December 1967 issue of Playboy, he said, "I have on occasion been told what seemed to be a straightforward story, when suddenly the witness lapsed into a highly confidential mood and told me that he was sure that his phone was being tapped or that he was being watched, sometimes on a regular schedule either by the government or by occupants of the craft." Following the death of Snippy the racehorse in Alamosa, Colorado, attributed to a flying saucer, there were several strange incidents in the area. One witness, a university student, wrote a letter to Riley Crabb, director of the Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, in which he told of the odd things which had happened to him after his consecutive sightings of a bright UFO on September 17, 1967, and another made in the company of 100 fellow students at Highlands University, the following Wednesday. "The day immediately after this sighting, I received a phone call from a friend who said that his life had been threatened if he so much as magnified the incident to higher authorities. He said I should refrain from doing the same. A week later, Crabbe's correspondent was out riding with a detective who serves as night police on the campus. They drove up into the mountains near Galena's Canyon to get a view of the town. Suddenly, a light appeared in the sky.